All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What the fuckabillies? What's going on? How are you? Good to see you. Nice to be here. Thanks for coming. I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. Hope you're enjoying your day so far. Hope you're having a nice drive or a nice run or perhaps a nice bath. Be careful in the bath. If you're listening to me on something that's not a battery-operated device, don't die in the tub while listening to me. Before I get into me, I want to say that I have one of the great psychedelic geniuses on the show. I don't know if he'd like being called that, but a masterful painter of the realms of the mind. Robert Williams, the genius painter, is on the show today. I went over to the Barnsdale Art Park, where he had basically a retrospective along with some juxtapose collection. And, you know, certainly you can look up Robert Williams. He's got a lot of amazing books out of his work. And, you know, he goes all the way back to Zap Comics, maybe a little before. Dude's been around. He was down here in L.A. with Von Dutch and Big Daddy Roth making hot rods and doing pinstriping. And he was up in San Francisco with Art Crumb and S. Clay Wilson and Spain and the fellas doing the panels. And now he does big paintings, little paintings, prints of all kinds. He's a very aggressive and profound imagination. And it was a real honor to talk to the dude because his paintings blew my fucking mind. It's always nice when I can get one of the original mind blowers on here. You know, for me, there's only a few. There's a small Mount Olympus of mind blowers that defined how I see the world. Williams came late to me, though I don't think I registered him initially in the Zap Comics as being Robert Williams, but later on, the paintings were like a complete mindfuck, and when I saw them in person, I was excitedly devastated in the best way possible. So Robert Williams will be talking to me. Also, my buddy Nate Bargatze, one of the funniest humans I know, has got a special coming out. So he stopped by the other day. We were at Moon Tower together, and he stopped by. His hour-long Comedy Central special, Full Time Magic, is on Saturday, May 2nd at midnight. It's 11 Central. And me, Mark Maron, the Marination Tour is extended. We're going to Cleveland, Chicago, Minneapolis, Port Chester, New York, Brooklyn, New York, Huntington, New York, Red Bank, New Jersey, Portland, Oregon, and two venues, Boulder, Colorado, Denver, Colorado. You can check out all the dates. They're up at WTFpod.com/calendar. But I do want to give you a quick heads up for certain people in certain cities where the pre-sale is happening today until 10 p.m. That's for the Playhouse Square in Cleveland on June 5th. You can use the promo code PERFORMER. For Minneapolis, the Pantages Theater on June 7th, promo code PERFORMER. For Huntington, New York at the Paramount Theater on June 27th, the promo code is PULSE. Portland, Oregon on July 10th and 11th at the Aladdin Theater and Revolution Hall, promo code MARIN. Boulder and Denver, Colorado, July 24th and 25th at the Boulder Theater and the Paramount Theater, promo code MARIN. All the venues are officially going to go on sale tomorrow, May 1st. So again, go to WTFpod.com/calendar for all the dates. And get involved in those pre-sales. Nate Bargatze and I hung out. Him, myself, Kurt Metzger, Todd Barry, went to get some barbecue at Moon Tower. And old Nate said that he was going to be in town here in Los Angeles for a couple days. And I had not realized he moved to Nashville. He just, under the radar, moved to Nashville, Tennessee, where he grew up. I'm going to talk to him about that right now and about his new special. As I said, that airs this Sunday, May 2nd, Full Time Magic, at midnight and 11 Central on Comedy Central. So my buddy Nate stopping by. Nate Bargatze. How long did it take me to get your name right?
A long time. A lot of people still say Bargatze.
Because of me?
Oh, no. You called me Nick.
So, the Nick thing, that wasn't a real thing. A lot of people call you Nick after that?
Yeah, that was, people, like, looked up Nick Bargatze. I remember I told you, I said on, like, when you could look at something on my website, it was, like, the fourth
Nick
thing was Nick Bargatze.
Didn't I correct it?
You did, but you said my last name right.
Oh, good.
Hey, we were just happy to be...
Yeah, halfway there?
Halfway, yeah.
Yeah, something yeah. identifiable that yeah. they could have...
I think I told you it would be... You know what? It might be easier for me just to change my name to Nick than try to go...
But was that before I talked to you?
It was right at the beginning. I thought you said it on The Nerdist, like when you did.
Oh,
it was
okay. Then right after I met you.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
And we were talking about that, and you thought, like, there it is, my big opportunity to get mentioned on the Nerdist podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I fucked it up.
I was just going to change my name to Nick.
That's right.
That would be the easier way. That's easier. That's less people to tackle than...
So what the hell happened? You were out here in L.A. living in... Where were you living? Somewhere in...
Oh, we were way down.
Like
Carson.
Carson?
Yeah, near Torrance.
So you're down there in Carson, near Torrance.
Yeah.
With your new baby.
New baby.
Driving up into the city to do 10-minute spots.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're gone. That was it.
That was it. Yeah.
What happened with the show, with the Fallon produced pilot?
We did it 2 years in a row, and nothing happened.
They did scripts.
Scripts.
Yeah.
Sold 2 scripts, and then wrote them, and neither one of them got picked up, and so now we're here.
Is that when you decided, sort of like, well, I don't need to live here?
I thought we did it before I moved in December.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I get like, well, I'm just like, well, I'm just going to do it. And I say it was the first thing I've ever done in the, you know, I've left Nashville in 13 years. So like,
so you moved back to Nashville?
Yes. I moved back to Nashville. It's the first thing I've done in 13 years that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Everything's always been this.
Oh,
you know,
so this was selfless.
This was the first selfless thing. I mean, I just leave there.
Yeah. You owed it to your wife and your new child.
To give them a chance to, you know,
have a life.
Not have to be in the dicey streets of Carson by themselves.
while you're out at the improv.
I'm out at the improv.
Drinking.
Hotel, drinking, just, you know, be like, life's great, whatever.
Yeah, calling your wife up going, how's everything?
What's going on? Did they catch that guy that shot that guy? And then she's like, I don't know, you know. So we heard a guy get shot in our neighborhood.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You did the right thing, and now you're not drinking anymore.
Yeah.
You're living in Nashville. You got a house.
Got a house.
Right down the street from your parents.
Yeah.
See, that was, but I think on some level that was a smart move in a selfish way to have the parents nearby, because then you can have some time.
I can
take
go.
Take the child.
Yes. Yes. We can give her, my mom comes over. And
they're happy to, right? Grandparents.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We have a bunch of, my brother has 4 kids and my sister has a kid, so like, all the cousins and stuff, and one of my nieces is like 9 months older than my daughter, so they're like best friends.
Yeah.
And so them being around, and she's going to all these birthday parties, and you know, I mean, she's like, you know, instead of just being her and my wife
down in Carson,
hold up, and now we're, you know. And I got a room out here that
you
I can
do?
Come to. Well, my buddy has an extra room downstairs.
Oh, really?
I noticed you have an extra room.
Yeah, I mean, you can stay in there with the records.
With the records.
There's a bed up against the wall. You just throw it.
It's like a Murphy bed?
It's like a Murphy bed that just covers the window.
It's not even hooked into?
No, it's a mattress. I it's a promotional thing.
It's like the first idea for a Murphy bed.
Yeah.
Like guy walks in and goes, what if you...
Put that in the wall.
Go with me. Yeah. That's how Murphy bed starts.
Yeah. So what's Nashville? What's the plan, man?
The plan is, I'm not sure what the plan is. I was very nervous about I was trying to move and not tell anybody.
Really?
That was the idea.
Because you were embarrassed? You were ashamed?
I wasn't embarrassed. I think you still feel that everybody thinks you just quit comedy.
Oh, yeah. You're out of the game.
You're out of the game. You're done.
Gave up.
Yeah.
Ran away.
You still have that mentality. So I just literally did it and didn't tell anybody.
I think when I talked to you at Moon Tower, you're sort of still in this justifying period. You're like, hey, you know, show business is in Nashville.
Yeah.
My agent has an office there, though they primarily deal with country musicians.
Like you didn't give me what I wanted out of it either. Like, you want everybody just to be like, yeah, dude, I think that's so smart that you did it. And I don't think I got that from you. I got like... Oh, yeah. And then I'm just like, oh, boy.
No.
We already
I think
did
it's
it.
Great.
Yeah.
You're a comedian that has a career in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You decided that it's a good idea to turn your back on show business and move to Nashville and engage that show business.
Well, every time I'd go to meetings, they all think I live in Nashville anyway. Like, I would go, like, just because of my accent or if I say something and like they're just assume I live there.
Now what are you gonna do though? So how are you gonna infiltrate? What's the plan? Are you gonna be the next generation of the
blue collar guys?
Well, I didn't want to say it.
Yeah.
But
no, it's out there. I mean it's already out there. No, it's not out there.
If you just get one of those blue collar guys to go out with you on tour, are you in contact with any of those fellas?
Some.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You talked to Billy Ball.
No, I've never talked to Foxworthy. I golfed in Nashville, and Larry the Cable Guy was golfing in front of us.
Who?
Larry the Cable Guy.
Oh, yeah, Dan?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I told him, I said, I can tell how long someone's been in comedy is if they refer to you by Dan.
Yeah.
Then I know that they've been around for a while.
I remember him at the Comedy Store briefly.
Yeah.
He was a good guy.
He was the nicest dude in the world.
Yeah.
And real cool. And it's funny. So I'm a big Vanderbilt fan, which is the school in Nashville, and I did not go there. And so we took a picture with me and him, and he's
you and Larry the Cable Guy.
Me and Larry the Cable Guy. And it's he is all Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
He's a big Nebraska fan. And so he's got all Nebraska stuff on, camouflage, dressed just like you would expect him to be dressed. I'm wearing all Vanderbilt stuff. So it almost looks like if they're trying to create a new Larry the Cable Guy, and their idea is like, we're going to go, his school instead of Nebraska will be Vanderbilt, will be a smart school. And people are like, well, that, you know, I don't know, that could turn people off. You're like, here's the thing. He did not go there. That's the hook. That's the hook that gets him in to go. You think, oh, is this guy a smart guy? No. He is far from it. And just wears all the Vanderbilt stuff.
So this special is one. It's on Comedy Central.
Yes, this Saturday, May 2nd, which is the night of the Mayweather Pacquiao fight.
The Comedy Central special is on this Saturday.
You can buy it May 5th.
So have you gotten to know your daughter at all?
We have crossed paths at the house, and she's 2.5. She'll be 3 in July. It went from like the first, at the very beginning, I remember once we were home, we'd go home for Nashville too, like sometimes for like a month. Like if I was going to be on the road, it was just easier to go home.
Yeah.
And, we'd stay at my parents. And, so I remember one time I was packing and she started packing like her Minnie Mouse suitcase and was like, oh, I'm going with daddy, you know? And that was brutal. Cause it was like, you know, that one hurt. But now it's actually brutal for me because she's almost fine with it.
Yeah.
Now I come home for like, you know, I was in New York and then I went home for a day. Then I flew out to Austin and here, and so I've been gone for like 2 weeks besides one day. And she's just kind of like, you know, she's happy to see me, and then just kind of like, all right, see ya. You know,
that's worse.
Yeah. So you going on the road this week? She says, yeah.
Did she say that?
No. She goes, are you featuring or are you headlining? And I'm like, this weekend headline. You know, I'll probably do some guest spots. But like, you know, we'll see what happens.
But you know, that probably has more to do with the fact that she has more friends around.
She has more friends.
And I think it gets to a point where they don't really like you or care about you.
Yeah, with FaceTime. FaceTime's big.
How long does that last though? Yeah, I mean,
we're FaceTime for a little bit. Like it's not, we're pretty good at like, you know, you don't want to keep anybody awkwardly.
Yeah.
Like where it's like, okay. Like, you know,
where your 2-year-old daughter says, okay, daddy, I'm done.
All right.
Good luck with everything.
I just see her moving her hands like, he keeps going.
He's
and
to
going.
Your wife. She's like, daddy's just yapping.
Nonstop. All right. You're on the road.
Yeah.
I almost like the idea too. I wanted to move and like almost see if anybody would know.
Yeah.
Just to be like,
who would know?
To prove a point, no one would know because we don't ever see anybody,
right?
Because we're either you're on the road or you go do your spot and you're done. Like I'd have to go if I want to go see you, I have to go find you.
We got
to
be at a festival.
We have to be at a festival, yes. And you can just go do it.
Well, that's. I think it's going to be good. Are you going to?
I hope it's good.
Well,
I had this whole idea I wasn't telling anybody, and then here we are now. So
making the announcement for the special. What's the special called?
Full Time Magic. Yeah.
Oh, it's based on your dad. Yeah, now, your dad's out there doing the magic.
He goes on the road.
Did you grow up with him going on the road?
Yeah, he went on the road all the time. I don't know if I ever like put it together. I don't think I pay attention to details of things.
To your parents, because you got your own life to live.
Yeah, but and now when I think back, it's like, I just would be like, I don't know, like he just wouldn't be like a baseball game. You're like, I don't know, why is he not here? You know,
yeah.
And then it's like now I'm like, oh, he was like,
doing magic somewhere.
God knows what kind of gig he was having to do. Like in the 80s, like just some awful road gig, and I'm just like, he should have came to my game. I don't know why he didn't come to my game.
Yeah, he didn't come to your game because he's somewhere going like, is this your card?
Yeah, yeah. He's somewhere doing that. Yeah. He didn't come watch me, I don't know, not
grow
make
up.
It in baseball. Yeah.
You didn't make it in baseball because he was out there, you know, pulling coins out of people's hair.
Yeah.
Out of their ears. My son is fatherless and wayward.
He wasn't gone. He had a regular job. He taught. He was a teacher, too.
Oh, that's right.
So he...
Does he do tricks for your kid?
Mm-hmm. They like it, and he does stuff for all our nephews and nieces.
He'll do parties if they're family?
Yeah, yeah. People still ask me, they'll be like, hey, will you... They want to get my dad to be a clown, because he started as a clown.
Yeah.
And they wanted him to be a clown for, like, their part, you know. And so you have to, like, tell him, like, guys, he's not... He doesn't do that anymore. You know what I mean? It's almost like, if someone wants you to come, hey, will you come do
these
some
These are
time?
People you grew up with?
Yeah. Like, now they have kids and being like, hey, could we hire your dad? Like, yeah, yeah. He would still love, like, they just picture that he doesn't move up at all. It's like if you have someone, a friend that will be like, you know, you're doing this great, you got your own show on TV and still be like, hey, could you do some time maybe at my wedding? And you're like,
I don't do,
it's not what I do anymore, you know?
I don't even know you that well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all right, I mean, how much time do you want me to do it? And then you do it. And then you get...
Well, that's so weird about people that they're so much in their own heads. How are they going to know that? I mean, they might not even know you're where you're at. They'll just see you around town and be like, is your dad still, because we got kids, he's going to have a birthday party.
Yeah, you know what one of my biggest things when you mentioned me and Rolling Stone?
Yeah.
That was one of the first things that I felt. And I already did a few late nights and all that.
Right.
And that was the first thing where I felt like people
this guy's a guy?
Yeah, no, they were just impressed, friends, high school friends were like, that was like a...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that was like a, oh, wow.
So the special's an hour?
An hour. That's another one people don't know. They're like, you tell them, like, I'm doing an hour, and they're like, oh, didn't you already do that? You're like, no, that was a Comedy Central Presents half hour. And you're, you know, it's like, this is like much more time than that and harder to get. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay. Like, I don't, yeah.
They don't know
I don't know what you have to do. You have to be Seinfeld before someone will be like, okay.
That's exactly right.
He's made it.
That's exactly the truth. That is the worst part about what we do, is that even my parents, it doesn't matter. My father be like, you know, you should maybe call Bill Maher, ask him how he did it.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm doing fine. But if you don't enter the culture like everyone knows you.
Yeah, where they even if you don't want to know, they know. But you're pretty far. I mean, I don't know how, like, it's crazy. I think my mom's the one that said that. She's like, didn't you already do one? And then I got really mad at my mom, who's so supportive. But I was like, so
she didn't understand.
Yeah, I was so like, are you serious? That was a half hour.
Yeah.
This is a full, you think they just hand these out?
Yeah.
I'm like,
do they?
Yeah, it's pretty easy to get, to be honest. It's like,
so, all right. So, we'll watch the special, and it's good to see you.
Yes, thanks for...
How long are you in town for, just
till Friday.
Oh, what are you doing?
You know, Hollywood stuff. I don't know. Meetings. I'm doing Matt at Midnight.
You've done that before.
Mm-hmm. We did it.
Me and you did it. Oh, yeah. That's right. It's a big day. I won, didn't I? No, I didn't.
You and Natasha. Did Natasha win?
I think Natasha.
I got knocked out.
Oh, that's right. That was sad. I felt bad for you.
Oh, I was out of there.
It wasn't immediately. It's at the end that happened.
Yeah, it's at the end, and then y'all stay, and then...
And then the light goes out on you.
Yeah, they make it a red light, really,
It was sad, man. I think a lot of people were upset by it. It was a shake-up.
By Megan, yeah. Wasn't it good?
It looked like it was anti-Southerner.
Well, a lot of stuff is, you know?
Yeah, I know.
So,
well,
it's all coming back.
That's your journey, though, is to bring back the pride.
To get the Civil War started back up.
Sure. Well, I don't know if that's a good... It seems like it's already starting around the country. I think what you're trying to do...
You can only hand out so many flyers.
Bridge the gap.
Yeah, yeah.
Between us, highbrow,
I come in
condescending.
I know what y'all are doing.
Yeah.
I know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Honestly, we're all on the same page. We're all doing the same thing.
You just have to listen.
You just talk differently. Yeah, that's all it is.
Yeah, stop projecting.
Attack Manhattan and L.A.
Yeah.
They're the only two different people.
And then, you just infiltrate with a bunch of you, talking the way you do with your sort of homespun wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll all come around.
Yeah.
All right.
That's
the agenda.
Yeah, that's going to be my next special.
All right, Nick. Well, it's great talking to you.
Nick Bargatze, Full-Time Magic.
Nate Bargatze, Full-Time Magic. All right, buddy. I'll talk to you.
Thanks for doing it, buddy.
Yeah. Love that guy. Watch that special, Full Time Magic, Saturday, May 2nd at midnight, 11 Central. I think it airs again right after. So, Robert Williams, man. I think that I'm sort of hung up on the idea, you know, the different identities that we go through, the different personas we try on, not personas, but whatever you can get away with your attire, whatever that implies. The first time and the only time I was in rehab was back in 88, maybe 87. And in there was a dude named Milo. And I don't know if Milo made it. I don't know where he's at or whether he's alive, but, you know, he came in pretty whacked out of his mind from staying up too long on some substance, doing dope and doing coke and doing speedballs and hearing the voices and keeping guard just in case someone wants to steal your brain, that kind of stuff. Quietly sweating in the shed, you know, waiting for some shit to go down because the dispatch was made, if you understand what I'm saying. But I got close to Milo, and he was a hardcore dude. And Milo had the a goatee before goatees were happening. But this was not the standard goatee that goes along with the bro shirt or the acid wash pants with the elaborate pockets. No, this was a goatee that went along with a bike, a motorcycle, and maybe a little jail time, maybe not. But he was a hardcore motherfucker, and he smoked Lucky Strikes. And, you know, when I was in rehab that first time, I was pretty shattered. Whatever personality I had become a bit fragmented, a bit wobbly. Was fragile to begin with. So I remember when I was in rehab, I listened to Milo tell stories, and then he had a carton of Luckies, and I was smoking those Luckies until they hurt my fucking lungs. I take his Luckies. I buy a pack of my own because I want to be like him. And then I grew out after rehab. I grew out the Fu Manchu thing, but not. It was before they were hip or cool. This is the late 80s, so you know, I was going for the hard look. I'd pull my hair back into a longish ponytail, and I had my round glasses on that were tinted all the time, and I had my jailbird biker goatee, and I wore my long trench coat, and I was about, what, how old was I? About 25 years old, and I think I was wearing the Milo costume for a while because I thought it made me look like I had been places, and I had lost my mind, but I'd never been to jail, I never rode a bike, and I don't think I could kill a man, but I think that my beard looked like it could at that time. Why did I tell you that story? Because there's something about what Robert Williams sort of represents about the 60s, about hot rods, about motorcycles, about cars, about speed, about, you know, unleashing your imagination, about that darker part of the 60s that sort of I believe I always aspired to. And through the Milo costume, I believed I had been there. Eventually, I shaved it and took me about a decade or two to get straight with who I was, but I think I'm here now. I got to tell you, I was nervous to interview Robert Williams because he was intimidating to me. I went to his opening. I met him briefly there. My buddy Coop, Chris Cooper, the poster artist and painter, is a big fan, obviously, and very influenced by Robert Williams and his personal friend, and he facilitated an introduction at the opening. I met him, and Robert, in my mind, very quickly dismissed me, and I projected a lot onto that. I just didn't think I was hard enough or serious enough or, you know, like the real deal enough for him to even register. I projected that gift on him, that he could judge me thoroughly through to my soul that quickly. But I was nervous. So I met him over at the gallery where he did the show, where his art was hanging. And he was with his wife, who was not in the room. We were in the office there. So you might hear a phone ringing occasionally. And I was intimidated. And, you know, I really wanted to have a good conversation with him because I do respect his work. So here is me trying not to be nervous with Robert Williams.
Well, I'm a tremendous fan of yours, and I have been for a long time.
You could do worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the two wives ago, the woman that became my first wife worked at Shafrazi when in.
Really?
Yes. And I remember like knowing that you were there and going to see the things. The first time I saw the canvases in person, like I'd only seen them in books.
Yeah.
And there's that moment where, you know, you see someone's work outside of a book and you're like, holy shit. Like the layers of work that went into those paintings and all your paintings, I couldn't believe it. It was like mind blowing to me to see it live.
Yeah.
Is that an odd thing to hear?
No, it's not, because there's when you see a painting in reality, there's a certain disappointment and also a certain pleasure in seeing it. A printed formalizes it.
Yeah.
You know, when you actually see it, you can actually see hand strokes and suffering and energy and thought into something, you know.
When you see the painting.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's exactly the whole texture of the thing.
Yeah.
Now, like in terms of your like styles of how you painted, it was much more laborious at a different point in time, right? In terms of the techniques you used.
Well, I've never been lucky enough to find the easy way out on these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've always in my mind think, well, I better find some shortcuts. But on the other hand, I think, well, here's a nicer way to do it. And that nicer way to do it is always more time consuming.
And like, what was the nicest way you found where it was taking you a year?
Well, to get the better effect.
Yeah,
see,
sure.
I said, well, this will give a remarkable effect. And hell, that's another 2 or 3 days doodling around with that, you know?
Right, right.
So it's kind of a losing game. It's not a rational person's occupation.
No. But you, I mean, obviously, you have to be somewhat obsessed with it. I mean, in order to do it, I mean,
it's more than obsession.
Yeah,
it's more than obsession, and it's more than fulfillment. It's like your worth.
Yeah,
you know, it's like when I was young, I wanted to be a slick artist and be a big operator.
Yeah,
be a hip dude.
Yeah.
Track the chicks and everything. And
sure.
I did an immense amount of studying of technical painting tomes and books and whatnot on technique, things from back from the 1850s on to modern times. And I memorized all these color combinations and what paintings were transparent and what paintings weren't transparent and whatnot. And my ego projected me into learning this stuff, but then as I got into the realities of selling the stuff and finding even a venue that would dare show the stuff, I was kind of at odds there. But by this time, by my time of my late 30s, the painting owned, the skill owned me. It was
right.
No longer me trying to be a slick egotist.
Yeah.
You know, the practice every day and the habits and the mixing the paints owned me, and I could do it automatically.
See? Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
So I was left with, you know, I've got this thing I've developed here, and I'm not getting any recognition, but on the other hand, nobody else seems to be able to do it, and I'm not going to do anything else, you know. And at the same time, I was doing comic books too. I was involved in Zap Comics.
Sure.
And my same problem developed there. I got into spending too much time in the comic books. A good comic book artist would do at least a page a day, and it was taking me a week a page, you know. So I just there's like something wrong with my mental value of being practical and rational. There's
but wasn't
a
it
problem
a it's
there.
A perfectionism, though, really, right? I mean, you had a process.
Yeah, right? Yeah. But I caught on real early on what Salvador Dali said. If you're looking for perfection, forget it. You'll never find it, you know.
But is that something you can actually do intellectually? I mean, if you're wired to say, like, well, this isn't quite good enough, I mean, you're never going to get around that.
Well, let me point this out to you.
Yeah.
If you're a young artist, say you're 10 or 12, and you're just taking art classes at school, and you sit down to a canvas or a drawing, you have an idea, there's a chance that when you get through with that project, that it's going to be maybe 25% of what you intended. And you do project after project, and it'll probably be about 25% of what you intend, unless it's a tic-tac-toe or something.
Sure, sure, sure.
Or a stick figure. So when you get to be in your late teens, your early 20s, and you start into college, you know, and you you get up to maybe 40-45%. But by this time, you've learned to keep your mouth shut, and let, when you get a piece of artwork done, you give the impression that this was what
exactly
your total intention was.
Yeah.
So you learn to shut your mouth,
right,
you know.
Right.
But you're still hitting about 45. You
know? Right.
Yeah. Okay, you get into your late 20s and your 30s, and you sit down to do a piece of artwork, and you got it in your head. Well, that's going to be, if you're pretty slick, that's going to be about 60 or 65%.
Right, right.
Now, I'm an old man. I'm 72, and I can hit about 80% now. So I have an idea, and I sit down to do it.
Right.
But I don't tell people that. See?
No.
I tell them, no, it's a 100-pointer. You know, every lick was intended.
Yeah, right.
That's just the nature of genius.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Now, when I first met you, it was interesting because I didn't know if I'd put you off or not, because I met you with Coop, who has also done this show and who I'm friends
yeah.
with.
And he's a good friend, too.
He's a great guy. And the first thing I said to you was like, you know, I grew up in Albuquerque. And you said, I'm sorry.
you grew up in Albuquerque.
I did. And I thought like, well, wow. This is a surefire way to connect with the dude in a heartbeat and make an impression. But you were like, oh, boy.
No, yeah. No. You
misread that?
You misread that. Yeah. That's just... You're a lot younger than me, and I wonder what your life was like in Albuquerque compared to mine.
Yeah, well, what was
left? I was there in the 40s and 50s.
I can't imagine, man. So what was there? Like, there was Kirtland Air Force Base?
Well, there's three Air Force bases.
Yeah.
There was Sandia, right. Kirtland, and Manzano.
Right.
My mother said it perfectly when I was a little kid. She says, watch out for Albuquerque because it's still a frontier town. And
uh-huh.
she couldn't have said it better.
Uh-huh.
Because between criminal activity on the street... and the brutal police department, you know, you
still,
yeah, that's right. I was in fights and in jail all the time in Albuquerque.
How'd you end up there?
Well, you mean in fights or in jail?
No, in Albuquerque.
I was born there.
Yeah,
I was born there in '43. My parents were married and divorced four times. My father was from the Deep South, so I was going back and forth from Alabama, Georgia, Florida, back to Albuquerque.
Yeah,
you know. So I come up from not only a broken home, but a terribly torn apart home.
Over and over again.
Over and over again.
With the same characters.
And my father had a sizable amount of money. He was fairly wealthy.
What was his racket?
My father's had the largest drive-in restaurant in the world that serviced 100 cars at one time and had its own theater and its own radio station.
Where was this?
Montgomery, Alabama.
Wow.
And his good friends were Hank Williams and Gene Krupa and a lot of people, you know.
They came through and
well, he knew Hank Williams very well.
And you remember him as a kid?
Oh, yeah. But then when I go back to Albuquerque,
yeah.
I'm just totally broke, you know.
Right.
So I went from this one lifestyle to the other, you know. And then in Albuquerque, it was a real reality check, you know, of fighting continually and getting in trouble and... I don't know. I've developed a lot of character in me. But on the other hand, my father was a military man, and he sent me to a strict military school. So I was... I was raised with this inferiority complex that had to be... that had to face up to Nietzsche. You know?
The only
way I was going to get out of my inferiority complex is start Nietzscheing it, you know?
Go above.
I had to stand up to Friedrich Nietzsche, you know?
Grit
my teeth.
Yeah.
You know, and fight these guys on the street and get my ass kicked and whatnot, but it happened time after time, you know.
When you were in Albuquerque, what high school did you go to?
I went to Highland High.
I went to Highland High. I graduated from Highland High. I'm sorry.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I was thrown out.
Right behind the Highland Theater.
Yeah.
Right there.
Do you remember that that bowling alley over by the Highland High?
I don't know if it was there when I was there. If it was still
there was a rumble there with over 300 people, and they were in there throwing. I was involved in it, and they were
really.
They were throwing bowling balls. Pachucos went in there throwing bowling balls, and there was knife fights, and people were stabbed. And,
the Pachucos, which later became the Cholos.
Well, we used to call them Chooks. There was
right.
there was the Stomps, which were the Cowboys, and then there was the Chooks.
What were you?
I was kind of I ran with both of them, really.
Right,
you
right,
know,
right.
Kind of,
you can move through. All fields.
Pathetically.
Well, you must have been a funny guy.
Well,
Usually it's a sense of humor.
I had my antennas out. You know, I was a young kid that learned real quick. You know, when I'd walk down the street, I'd always look two blocks down.
Yeah.
Learned real quick. You know, walk down the street, look two blocks down. Because you might want to cross the street.
Right.
You
know? Yeah, there's three of them.
Yeah.
Right. So what was that?
Well, I don't want to go in. I have so many of these vulgar street scene stories that could fill a book. Let's go on about the art.
Okay. I'm completely willing to do that. Where did I saw a picture of you and I don't remember where. Maybe it was in the Malicious that collection, that big book. What was it? Malicious Resplendent.
Yes.
Of you at the Albuquerque State Fair.
Yes.
And you know, I was sort of obsessed with the State Fair. You know, I was obsessed with.
I worked there as a concessionaire, and when that carnival moved, I went with it.
And what were you doing?
Pitch them in, win them out, take home some dishes.
You know? Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I played the cigarette game and a number of games.
I've always been obsessed with, like after I saw, I had a book called Very Special People, you know, and then I was obsessed with the anomalies, with freaks. And I remember going to the State Fair to see Ronnie and Donnie.
See, that's after my time. I saw freaks. There was freaks in the 10-in-1 show when I was there that I saw back in the early 50s.
Right.
You know.
Because I feel like
Pico and Ico, the sheep-headed men from Labrador, Johnny Ick.
Johnny Ick was still around?
Yeah.
And you saw those guys. And the reason I bring that up.
I talked to them. I traveled with them.
You traveled with Johnny Ick?
And the other characters, too. Yeah.
And because I have to believe that informed your eye somehow.
Absolutely. The tawdry side of cultures always fascinated me. It's always seemed romantic to me. It was seemed like the kind of thief society that was in Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Right.
You know? And it's a very, very dangerous world to function in as the lower classes and the criminal classes. And I was always attracted by the romance of petty criminals. And later I understood what my problem was it wasn't really that I had these criminal tendencies. It was just that I was in a small town like Albuquerque that hadn't developed a full bohemian community.
Wasn't there.
It was very small around the University of New Mexico.
Right.
I was always in trouble with the police and whatnot. And then I become a chess hustler. Around University of New Mexico, and I was just a kid.
But you were compelled towards that scene. You're looking for the artist, the bohemian.
I very much involved myself in the beatnik movement in the late 50s.
You did?
Yeah.
In New Mexico?
There wasn't like a true literary beatnik world that we think of, the orthodox, but there was an urban beatnik world that had created all over the United States from seeing sorry movies but questionable Hollywood interpretations of the beatnik culture.
Right.
One of them was the Beat Generation.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that I remember standing out really a lot was Bell, Book, and Candle with Kim Novak.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of set the pattern for the United States of America to have a beatnik idea of how to conduct themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, very, I mean, I was 15, 16, very much into that world. You know?
And were you,
hung
were you
out at coffee shops and
sure.
smoked marijuana.
And were you doing art at that point?
I was always doing some kind of art.
What was going on? Where did it start? Where did you start defining yourself or knowing that was where you were going?
Well, before I had a developed memory, my parents would sit me down on a big roll of butcher paper with crayons,
sure.
you know, and I'd just take off. You know?
Yeah.
And I did a big red skeleton bone for bone, and it was Red Skeleton the comedian, you know?
Yeah.
And I was just out of diapers. And then there was a pop song called The Devil in My Darling's Eye, and I did a big eye with a devil in it, you know? And I'm just a little bitty baby.
Mm-hmm.
And in, I think, the fifth grade, they selected about six of the gifted kids, six or eight of the gifted students, to do a mural at the end of the hall.
Mm-hmm.
All these young, talented children would do their efforts, and then I'd draw back and look and see a thing here and a thing here and a thing here, and I'm the only one that could go up there and do a landscape tying them all together. I could only
right.
guy could unify.
Yeah.
So I really didn't get to do my little thing. My thing was unifying, and then if something was big, I'd put it on a hill close, big. If something small, you know, I could have
yeah.
perspective understanding, but to stage things.
Uh-huh.
So I had that innate ability.
So when did you, like, when the beatnik thing started happening, did you have some sort of aesthetic that you were gunning for? Like, you wanted to be part of?
Well, I real early on was taken with surrealism.
Right.
Really young. And I presumed that the beatnik thing, it was part and parcel of that. But I didn't have a real good grasp at the time of what abstract expressionism was.
Where'd you see surrealism first?
It was
the book.
Omnipresent. It was sure. Ubiquitous. It's in books and whatever.
Dali mostly?
Yeah, mostly. Dali. Yeah. Then that, of course, you know, Dali was a Johnny come lately, and then he was thrown out. He was kind of parasited off surrealism, and then got the whole name of surrealism, you know, and then they kicked him out, and that's still run off with the name of surrealism to this day, you know.
Yeah. Well, he lived to make bank, that guy.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. He was an operator, no doubt about it. He should have been a wrestling promoter.
He looked like one, in a way.
He was enormously talented. Oh, yeah. A rich imagination.
He had a carny sort of disposition.
You know, I went to a lecture, and there was this gal that knew him personally, and mm-hmm. she said that when you were with him just around the house or something, he talked perfectly normal. But when he got around a bunch of people, he started affecting that exaggerated accent.
Right. Yeah. Why not? Put on a show.
Yeah.
So, all right, so you're in Albuquerque. Did you ever know a guy named Gus Blaisdell, by any chance?
No.
He owned a bookstore later. I don't even know when he got there.
Well, I'd left in 63, and I kind of burned all my bridges.
So. You left running?
Well, it was a good thing I did get out. I probably ended up in Santa Fe prison. A lot of my friends did end up in Santa Fe prison, yeah.
Do you still have friends in New Mexico?
Just relatives.
Relatives.
A few hot rod buddies. When I go back to Albuquerque, I see a few hot rod buddies.
Is that when you first started doing hot rods?
No. I first started when I was in Alabama in 1955 at 12 years old. I got my dad to buy me a 34 Ford coupe.
Yeah.
So I was on to the hot rods way early. I started reading Hot Rod Magazine about 53.
So that was in your consciousness. That was something that drove you, literally.
That's right.
And because, like, the one thing I was, like, when I started going through stuff today, the intensity of, no matter how long it may take you to paint one of your paintings, I mean, the intensity and the velocity of the thing coming at you in all the ways that it comes at you, there's no avoiding it, and there's almost a speed to it.
Well, what I do, I have to kind of disregard the concept that this is going to be a decoration in a house. I see my paintings closer to literature than I do to...
The titles are literature.
If you have a sophisticated home, you have a coffee table with classic books on it to show people how intelligent you are, you'd have, like, maybe War and Peace or 2 Years Before the Mast or Tales of Two Cities, and it's really interesting literature. But as long as it's sitting on the coffee table and the pages are closed, it's okay, because there's stuff in there that would make your hairline recede. That would create diarrhea in children.
So,
unfortunately, art has to be tamed and knocked down because people can just look right at it. And that's a really a sad thing that literature is allowed to totally eclipse graphics. Comic book has kind of challenged that. The comic book is one of the most important things of the 20th century. 50 years from now, you look back on the 20th century, and you'll see that the cartoon dominated the art world. Cartoon was the most
important. From the beginning.
It was the most important thing of the 20th century.
Well, it was the first time I ever saw people having sex.
I agree with you. I've got some examples in this show here, those 8-page Bibles. Mm-hmm. I think it was like 1951. I was 8 years old, and some kid showed me one of them 8-page Bibles that he stole from his dad. And I'm looking at that, and that's how that works.
Exactly.
That's how that works.
The first time I saw it was a Spain picture. Like, it was in an underground comic collection of two bodies in space, and they're having sex. And I was like, that's how it worked.
And then about a few years after that, someone showed me a pornographic photograph at a baseball game. And the fellow was an ex-GI that just was stationed in Japan, and he came back and he had these pictures of these Japanese people in the act of sexual intercourse. And that didn't look interesting to me at all. That didn't look interesting to me at all,
the
seeing this guy's buttocks on top of another woman,
right.
on top of a woman. It just, That wasn't as good as the 8-page Bible.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when you set out to, you left Albuquerque to come here and study art practically?
Yes.
And where was the first place you studied?
I came out here to go to Los Angeles City College because it was only $6.50 a unit. Uh-huh. See, so I spent 2 years at Los Angeles City College, and I was nominated for the dean's list, and I did...
What were you working on specifically, just learning technique?
Yeah, sculpture and painting. And the college newspaper there, the Collegian, approached the art department for a cartoonist, an editorial cartoonist, and nobody could draw. You know, they approached the entire student body. Nobody could draw. So, I'll do it. What a wonderful opportunity to 20 years old to get in print.
Yeah.
You know, the first time to get something published, you know.
What were you drawing?
Just editorial cartoons, whatever the current subject was. And I won an award. It was a national contest, and I came in second nationally.
Yeah.
You know, of all the junior colleges. And after I quit the school, I still had to come over to me to get editorial cartoons done, you know. But I wasn't even a student anymore. So.
You're still making money doing that?
It wasn't very much money. It was enough money for me to get married on. But, you know, I let it build up for a long, long time before I bothered with it. You know.
So, all right. So after that, where'd you go next to
well,
continue?
Well, I went out and got a job, and then I took extension courses. I'd married my wife, Suzanne, that I met at...
Still City married?
Park. Yeah, still married.
Great.
And it was hard getting a real good job. I got a job as an art director for Black Belt Karate Magazine. And then at night, I would take extension courses at Chouinard's.
Yeah. So and that was a big deal?
That was a very big deal, history-wise now, because all your major artists in Los Angeles, the older ones, all went to Chouinard.
Did you jive with that school?
No.
Why?
Not at all. Well, when I came out to California... And I was a pretty good draftsman, and I was so enthusiastic, ready to get into the arts.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, all my influences were comic books and surrealism and B-movie posters and Hot Rod magazines and all this second-class influences. And so I come out here, and lo and behold, it's right in the middle of the abstract expressionist period. And drawing was considered absolutely out of the question.
Really? Not even as a groundwork? Not even, you got to learn this first? No one thought that way?
They had drawing and painting classes, but it was contour drawing of quick studies of a nude model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to knock that thing out pretty quick. You know?
Right.
You couldn't sit and nurse on this thing and get the shade tones right and whatnot. You couldn't work on muscle tone. Just quick impressions of a nude model, you know. So that's the closest thing they had to academic drawing. Now, their philosophy was that the representational art was a cheat. And it was a phony thing because you're trying to make something look three-dimensional and it's actually two-dimensional. And the arts after the Second World War, especially in the 50s and early 60s, was the art of truth and honesty. And art should reflect the honesty of the artist doing it and the impressions of the artist doing it. And if you paint it, it should look like paint. Hmm. If you chiseled wood, it should show the marks of the chisel. If you welded a sculpture, it should show the burnt slag on it, because that's the nature of it, see. They, of course, completely disregarded that 550 years ago, oil paint was invented to be tight. You know, that's the nature of oil paint if you can do it.
Yeah. See.
Wood can be polished and show the grain. That's also the nature of it.
You know?
Metal sculptures can be ground down and polished and plated. But they disregarded that. Now,
did you think it was bullshit?
No. No, because I was a young student and I realized I had to discipline myself to things that I wasn't used to and I'd had to take this in. Say, I had to. But I still had this tendency to tighten up. And then I had contemporaries, friends that were Otis and Chouinard's and UCLA, that referred to me as the illustrator.
Yeah.
That I was going in the wrong direction. And I really would not be a painter because my stuff's tight and it spoke of three dimensions.
So that got hung on you.
Illustrator.
That got hung on you back then. before
you. Well,
even...
it was a slander.
Right.
It was a slander. Now, what they don't understand, and what they, I would have to explain to them if I could get them by the scrub of the neck and drag them through five decades to face me now, was not only was there length and depth and width, there was, what would you call it, there was the element of time. So that's the fourth dimension, see? Something moving in the picture, that's time. And if there's something that's it's abstractly created in it, that's a violation of physics, which is the fifth dimension, see? So not only am I cheating in one direction here, I'm cheating in three more directions with the ability to have the mental capability to search things out.
Yeah, yeah. Any one of your canvases, it definitely, yeah. You time travel, there's story, yeah. There's a defying the physics, well, abstraction.
There is a situation that exists in art schools, and I really support art schools, and I do support abstract expressionism, and there is no bad art. But something does exist, it should be pointed out, that if you had 100 artists, and three of them were technical masters, and 97 of them could only pick their nose, the art of the time would be picking your nose. See, the three masters would be totally disregarded because they were creating a problem for the 97.
Right.
There's a democracy. Right. There's a graphic democracy, an art democracy, and I was facing that violation of that democracy when I was young, because if I did real slick stuff as a kid in art school, I was showing off, and I was trying to set the standards too high for the other young people that had other inclinations.
So you were an outsider on both counts. You're creatively an outsider, but also technically
threatening. I always end up outside the situation. I'm always in violation of the
right
social situation that I function in. I don't know what that is.
Well, it's like it's the great spirit of fuck you.
That might be, yeah, that immature.
I don't know if it's immature.
Contrariness that I have.
But you know. I don't know if it's immature. But I think that that democracy you're talking about only applies to maybe that education, because once you get into the art business, there's certainly no democracy at all.
No.
But like, okay, so. I'm seeing this these two experiences when you first get out here, and you go through technical and you get your shit together, so you're a wizard technically, and then you go to this sort of poetic of the time school. I imagine this was the first building block of this sort of like, well, I can do anything you can do, and I can do it better, mm-hmm. and I can integrate it, and you go fuck yourself.
Well, look, let me feign humility here. It's not. That I am such a great artist and so slick. It's just that everyone else is so fucking bad.
but the intelligence of what I think is your sense of humor, which I appreciate deeply, is that you can turn anything on its head and you can outdo what you're satirizing. So,
okay, I have to contradict you here. What I do is not primarily humor. It goes that one step beyond humor. It's abstract thinking. It has no punchline.
Okay.
It's not made to make you giggle. It's made to
blow your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. Yeah.
It's designed to realize that a situation here that's come from a mind that completely functions a lot more investigatively and off any logical practical. Train tracks.
Right. No. And you, but you have all these the intelligence and the skills in place to do it on several different levels within one canvas.
Yeah.
And you're blowing minds.
I appreciate you saying that. You're very generous with me.
So after you get out of that the abstract expression mindfuck that you were then subject
came,
to,
then came pop art and conceptualism. And right. You say, well, pop art, you're getting, that's realism. Well, yeah, it's realism, but it's art that's been appropriated.
That's right.
You cannot step out of pop art and do something that's free thinking. It has to be something appropriated. It's right, a reflection of the things around you.
But the people that define whether that's popular or not is such a small group of people, and it's rooted in like two or three intellectuals.
The whole thing is made up of failed artists,
Yeah. But so where did you go after that? How did you get from there to Big Daddy Roth and
well, I was a container after being art director for Black Belt magazine, and I lost that job, and then I had to go get another job, something art related, and I ended up desperately taking a job as a container designer for Weyerhaeuser Corporation. And that was a junior executive job where I wore a suit and tie.
What does that mean, a Weyerhaeuser container?
Weyerhaeuser is one of the biggest container companies in the world. They're forestry, have giant forestry and lumber and cardboard boxes.
So this was like an engineering job almost?
Well, I had to make commercial boxes for products. You know, I designed boxes. And this was during my psychedelic period, so it didn't take them long to realize that I wasn't executive stock.
So you were taking acid in designing boxes?
Yeah, so they fired me. So then I fumbled around, and by sheer divine providence, got a job with Ed Roth. I'd met him years earlier at a car show, and then I went to the unemployment agency, and they said, we don't have anything for you. We have this one thing, but nobody will take the job, and the conditions are not right. They're a little filthy down there. And I said, what is it? They said, well, they're looking for an art director down at Ed Big Daddy Ross. I said, give me the phone.
Yeah, and you knew him. You knew his work, and you knew his magazines.
I was a big fan of him. I knew him. I'd met him at car shows. And I was a hot rodder, you know, and I went down there and talked to him, and he looked at my portfolio, and he says, well, if I knew you were alive, I'd have hunted you up.
Oh, really? Yeah. So it was right away.
I just got this incredible job with an enormous amount of money, and then I could come and go and dress the way I wanted. I just had deadlines to fill. I was in charge of his advertising.
Well, what was it like over there? I mean, when you were in the hot rod, so you could take apart a car and put it back together and, you know, chop a car up. You did that stuff.
Yeah.
So what they were doing over there was like above and beyond, right?
Yeah, but I could stand there and talk to them. They weren't doing anything I didn't totally comprehend.
Right. And you guys hit it off?
Yeah.
And your job over there?
Yeah, when he understood that at 12 years old, I had a 34 Ford 5-1 coupe, you know, I mean.
You were in.
Yeah. I was,
Where did he come from?
His father, when he was born, he was living in Beverly Hills, and his father was Mary Pickford's chauffeur.
Really?
And his father was a German that belonged to the German Bund.
Uh-huh.
You know, real right-wing, strict German. Uh-huh. And he hated driving Mary Pickford around because on a couple of occasions she made him go pick up fertilizer in the limousine, you know.
Huh.
So Ed was an American kid that from German parents. I think he started out doing winded design for Sears Roebuck, and he was a remarkable sign painter and interested in hot rods. And
I wonder if the Eric von Stroheim character in Sunset Boulevard was based on his dad.
Well, there's a comparison there. I think about that. Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I think about that.
It just like struck me like immediately. Like,
yeah.
Huh.
Well, that's an impression I wanted to give you. Yeah.
That's the guy.
You can see him in a chauffeur's uniform with jodhpurs and black boots and a cap. You know.
And a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, standing by as the doorman to the limousine. You know, standing there pissed off because he had to go get fertilizer and bring it back in a Rolls Royce or a Duesenberg or something.
Yeah, that huge car.
Yeah.
So when you were over there, what were your jobs? I mean, what was the title job?
My first responsibility was get out about 6 ads a month. But then besides that, I designed T-shirts and decals, and I worked helping work on the cars a little bit. And I was just and since I was the only one there with a formal art education, I was kind of a front man there. When people come in and was talking about art and careers and stuff, he'd always get me to.
Oh, yeah? Go do some PR?
I had to.
Human resources?
I had the vocabulary, no one's going to snow me, you know, so.
And it was a scene over there, right?
It was a remarkable scene, a gypsy carnival scene. There's people coming in and out all day. There'd be movie stars and rock stars and
just
bikers and police and the FBI and beautiful chicks. And it's just like. He would go out of town on touring with every year he'd make a new car, show car, and then he would go on the circuit like a carnival, and then I would stay there and work with the crew that did T-shirts and stuff. And when he'd come back, he'd have all these followers come back, you know.
So he
picked up over the United States. He'd have all these hanger-oners.
Charismatic guy.
Yeah, and then they'd come in with some good-looking gal, you know, and then 3 weeks, everybody had worked there had gonorrhea, you know. it was beyond colorful, you know.
But it was like the Hollywood elite like dug it, and they would come down.
The rock world dug it, you know, and the car world is in the middle of the car and motorcycle world. And
now, what did you learn from him, like in terms of how it influenced, you know, how you moved through? Because obviously cartooning was, and he had a very specific style.
I gained confidence. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be snowed anymore by the art world. I had confidence, you know, and I was the first artist Ed allowed me to sign my name to the works.
Mm-hmm.
So I started getting a following, you know, and so I learned to do T-shirts. I really learned how to do black and white with not a pen, but with a brush, like a real cartoonist, you know, mm-hmm. a real comic book artist. And then I'd met Stanley Mouse, who's Ed's competitor, a car shirt designer at car shows. But Stanley Mouse had give up the car show circuit, and he went up to San Francisco, and he became one of the founders of the psychedelic poster movement, one of the called the Big Five.
Right.
You know.
Who are they? That's Griffin and Mouse?
Rick Griffin, Mouse, Kelly, Wes Wilson, and Victor Moscoso. Those were the Big Five that got into Life magazine in 1966.
That was a big article.
Before
we get up to San Francisco, what happened to Big Daddy Roth? What ultimately happened to that empire?
That's a whole show in itself. That's a couple hours. Yeah, he was the one that championed outlaw motorcycles. He was the first professional person. They used to be called Fat Bobs mm-hmm. before Choppers, and then they got to be called Choppers. And they were, because of the motorcycle gangs, they were really despised by society, and the hot rod world didn't want anything to do with them. I mean, he got involved with these guys.
Like the Angels?
Well, I don't want to go into names here, right. because I don't want any retribution here, but he got involved with a lot of really brutal bikers, and he promoted, he come up with the first outlaw biker magazine, you know, and he really promoted it, and he had a lot of trouble with them, and the IRS and the FBI moved in on him because they thought he was involved with these biker gangs, and they were under the impression that he had like some ruling control, and they just enacted what's called the RICO Act,
right.
the Gangster Racketeering Act.
So they thought he was a kingpin.
Yeah, so they moved in. The IRS just went right up his ass, and then the FBI was on him all the time, and the IRS found out that he was maybe fumbling in his books, but he was more honest than anybody. He was really a patriot, really loved America, you know,
yeah.
so he wouldn't cheat. In fact, any dealings I ever had with him, or any dealings I'd ever seen with anyone, everyone always got the best of him, you know.
Right, because he was a fair guy.
He was a very sweet and honest guy. But anyway, where was I going to go?
So they crushed him.
Yeah, they eventually crushed him, and I had that job as art director for 5 years, and his wife left him, and it broke him, and then he finally got a job at Knott's Berry Farm as a sign painter. He was really down on his luck and a low ebb, and then fortunately nostalgia came and picked him right back up again.
Oh yeah, the Rat Fink, the resurgence of Rat Fink.
Yeah.
And what about Von Dutch? We didn't talk about him at all. He seemed to be a...
Well, Von Dutch was very intelligent, enormously talented, very imaginative, but he was extremely right-wing. Right-wing to a fault.
Uh-huh. That's a nice way to say a lot of things.
Yeah, he was one of my childhood heroes. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
I
remember seeing him magazines 53, 54. You know, he's when it started pinstriping as a hot uh-huh. rod affectation, and he brought back flames from the 30s, you know, and he was a very imaginative guy. I could really relate to him until then I got to know him, and then people warned me about him. They says, well, you know, watch out for him because he goes crazy, and I got to be good friends with him, and, you know, we'd stay up till the sun comes up drinking beer and got along real well, and then one day he turned on me and threatened to kill me, you know, and so they were right. Watch out for him. You know, he's mentally ill.
Right.
He was mentally ill.
Well, you know, that happens. If you live in the world of artists, you know, you're going to meet a few mentally ill people.
Well, he would go into a biker bar. He reacted to people violently, and he'd go into a biker bar full of bikers, and he'd get up on the bar, stand up on the bar, and call them down for their costumes.
Oh, yeah.
And
so he had a death wish.
Yeah, you know, because he preceded these guys in the motorcycle world, and he saw them all as pretenders, you know. Mm-hmm. And they'd pull him off the bar and beat the hell out of him, and so.
That's how he lived.
You know, I was talking to one of the big biker chiefs, and I said, have you seen Dutch recently? And he says, yeah, I saw him about 2 weeks ago. Someone took a primary chain to him, beat his ass. And I'm bitching. Bitching, man. You know.
So. But what did you learn from him? Did you learn technique from him?
Not really.
He appreciated what he did.
He had an admiration for me. Mm-hmm. He really didn't know how to paint. Mm-hmm. He never got past using one shot. You can't blend one shot, see. And so he thought I was pretty slick. One shot is an enamel paint for pinstriping.
Okay.
And the pigments are so dense in them, they don't blend. You can't blend them, see. But he tried and made messes. But he had an appreciation for my painting skills.
Oh, yeah?
He said that... I paint like Dolly tries to paint, you know. I was kind of him, but he had some awful ugly things to say about me. He said I was the boringest person he ever met in his life. He was a chronic alcoholic, and I mean chronic. The first thing in the morning, he started drinking beer till he went to bed for years and years, and it finally got him in the liver. It was killing him.
Yeah.
Then he was getting bitter, more bitter. It wasn't like he wasn't bitter in the first place, but he got like chronically bitter.
About what?
So, well, about life in general and the races, and you know, he was just a very negative person. But on the other hand, he had this bohemian presentation. He was good friends with Lord Buckley at one time, and it's kind of a contradiction in life, you know. But when he saw his end was near, he wrote this last testimony on a piece of paper, and it run down the races and just how he's glad to get out of this world and all this. You know?
So it was a racist manifesto.
Yeah, it was a racist manifesto, and we fought the wrongs. We're on the wrong side in the Second World War and whatnot. And then he ended the letter by saying Heil Hitler, you know, and then. The guy that was taking care of him, Jim Brucker, I guess he got that letter to the Hells Angels, and then it got Xeroxed, and that letter got all over everywhere. And then this company comes along, and they start selling Von Dutch apparel. And I'm thinking, well, my goodness, when, you know, I saw blacks wearing them on television and all this stuff, and I thought, when is that letter going to surface, you know? Letter going to surface?
Never did.
10 years it took for that letter to surface, and it was in the L.A. Times verbatim, and it just killed this big company, just killed this clothing company.
Did it?
So they couldn't find a spokesman to defend him, and to keep coming to me, you know, the L.A. Times and television stations and New York Times, all these people come back to me, you know, here's a guy's going to kill me. So I had to explain to him, well, he was mentally ill, and, you know, he was my childhood hero, but he affected an entire generation, and he was a wonderful influence for a lot of people, but he was quite the bigot and mentally ill, you know, so.
So you put him in context.
Yeah, I tried. Uh-huh. I don't know if I did. I tried, you know, but I found myself being associated with him, which I didn't really want to do, you know, but no one else would come to his defense. The people that would come to his defense weren't articulate.
You know? Right. He sounds like you handled it diplomatically and correctly.
Well, that's a past chapter now.
So when you left town, so this was after Big Daddy Roth, you go to San Francisco, and there's...
I never lived in San Francisco. I had property up in Marin County.
Uh-huh. You still got it?
No, I sold a long time ago. I had property up there, and I was up there a lot. I spent a lot of time up there.
Hanging out?
Yeah.
So, and where'd you meet, like, S. Clay Wilson and Crumb and those cats? I love S. Clay
Wilson. I met these guys through Gilbert Shelton. Uh-huh. Now, Gilbert Shelton was doing car art back in the 60s through a publisher named Pete Millar that did a magazine called Drag Cartoons, and Pete Millar liked Gilbert Shelton's Wonder Warthog, and they did a couple of Wonder Warthog books about hot rods, and so I was dealing with the Print Mint to get some of my paintings published, and I'd seen this Zap comic, and it just really blew me away, and I asked for some pages, and then they hand this over to Gilbert, and Gilbert talked to Crumb, and I got a letter from Gilbert's inviting me in to get pages and Zap. So this was
68, so that's how it 69. Worked. It was pages. You were allotted pages.
Yeah. Well, they were very democratic about it. I become one of the seven owners of Zap.
Uh huh.
But
still.
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah.
The thing is, there was I was probably the eighth or tenth underground artist, underground cartoonist, comic book artist in the United States then. Mm. Say.
Yeah.
It was later that thousands and thousands of people jumped on the
Isn't it interesting how intimate the landscape was, media-wise, where...
Well, we were drawn together because we were all just, you know, we're fuck-offs that used to read EC Comics and, you know, and like carnival art. And,
yeah,
and we were a rare breed, very rare bunch of people, and we just immediately gravitated toward each other because we were just not socially worth much.
And you were defining a medium, whether you knew it or not.
Yeah.
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 And what was Clay Wilson like at that time?
Very much like his cartoons. Yeah. Very, very much like his
pirate.
Cartoons. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
he rode bikes. Were you riding bikes at that time?
I went through a period of motorcycle riding in the late 50s and had some bad accidents, and I saw the liability in that, and had a number of friends killed and maimed on motorcycles. And I love motorcycles. I just have the good judgment to stay off of them.
And you and Clay, who were you close with in that crew?
All of them.
Oh yeah, y'all just hung out.
Close with all of them.
Was there a community in the early Zap comics where you and Crumb and Spain and Clay and the other guys? I guess Griffin. Who were the seven?
Victor Moscoso and Gilbert Shelton.
Did you guys sit in a room and talk about what you wanted to do?
Yes.
What was the agenda?
Well, no, there was no agenda for the whole comic. Yeah. We sit in a room and do jams.
Okay.
Pass a piece of paper around and get drunk and have ladies around and party up in the hills there and have a lot of fun, you know.
Did you jam where you just add to the piece of art going around?
Yeah.
And you'd sort of collectively create this thing. You got any of those?
No. Those ended up in the hands of very wealthy collectors.
Oh, so they're around, though.
Yeah, Moscoso took care of those, and I think they sold them out to very wealthy collectors.
Oh, when did we get to see those? Are they in books?
Well, they're in all the Zaps. Each Zap had a jam in it.
How long? So you stayed with Zap the whole time. How many issues were there? 12?
Well, the last one that's in this book here is Zap 16, and then Crumb did an extra one, which makes it 17 issues.
You still in touch with him?
I talked to him about a year ago.
And Clay's not doing great.
No, he's not doing good. Alcoholism caught up with him. And then, you know, Rick Griffin died in a motorcycle accident in 81, and then Spain died 2 years ago from cancer. And so it was...
People are going. And now
we're
got
old
this.
Turds now, you know. Old people.
So after the Zap, you know, residency, you've been painting all the way through.
All the way through.
And
hopelessly.
Yeah.
In 1970, when Ed went out of business, a multimillionaire car collector came in and bought all of Ed's cars and bought all the original Roth artwork and then got interested in the artist that did the artwork and saw my paintings. And then he bought all my paintings. An enormous sum at that time. Enormous sum. It kept me going for years. So I couldn't get a show with that kind of art. And I
how many
get,
paintings?
Six or eight.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't get a show, and I couldn't get in a gallery, and sure couldn't get in an art magazine. And I just struggled along selling paintings. And punk rock movement come along, and I started licensing my paintings to punk rock groups. So then I built a whole new underground audience. So you had the Zap comic audience and the Roth audience, and then I started getting a little bit of the punk rock audience too. So
who were the guys who were doing that with you?
You have to remember the art world didn't have big audiences like this. You know?
Right.
They just had connoisseurs that they hope to gather, but I was
so
building
the late
up this
70s?
Giant fandom.
Yeah, late 70s?
Yeah, so in 80s. And so once I got in with the punk rock artist, you know, I had a peer group.
Who were they? Gary Panther?
Gary Panner, and Savage Pencil. There was a whole slew of them.
And they all looked up to you, I imagine.
Yes, because of the Zap thing.
Right, sure.
Because of the Zap thing.
Uh-huh.
They weren't necessarily tight artists, but I sloppied it up to get in with them. So, through that world, then I could get shows
at
these real marginal punk rock galleries. And then I just haven't sold out shows, so that got me to bigger galleries, And finally, I ended up in the 90s with Tony Shafrazi.
That was
like the second or third biggest gallery in the world at that time.
Yeah, it was a great show. I sort of coveted the what do you call it, the sock monkey.
The invitation.
The invitation, yeah. And I loved that thing, and I think that's when I got the first book. What we didn't mention was that the album cover for Guns N' Roses, The Appetite of Destruction, which I imagine they took the title of the album from your painting.
Right.
And that became like that. I think if people listening to this who don't know your work, I'm sure they've already gone to their computers to check it out, but that was a big piece because of how many people got that record.
Well, there were four paintings done that were called Super Cartoons, and that was one of the four paintings. And Axl Rose ran across it somewhere and wanted to use it for an album cover.
And that was good exposure, though, right?
Great exposure. I had to defend it, and I explained to them to pick something else when they wanted a cover. And I said, "This is going to be very problematic because
culturally,
I understand because I've been in underground comics and I know what problems are going to occur."
And you knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, I knew exactly. In fact, I told them exactly what the order was that things were going to happen. I said, your first problem is you're not going to be able to get this through the Canadian border. And the second problem is going to be church groups, and the third problem is going to be family and.
For that cover.
I told them the order of things that were going to fall.
And it all happened?
And I said, then the feminists are going to get on you and tear your pieces. And they're all just like I said. You know.
And you've dealt with that your whole career.
Yeah.
And your response has basically been, it's my imagination, fuck you.
Well, when we were doing underground comics, there was a point about 1970, that... It looked like during the Vietnam War, if the country went more right wing, they were going to start rounding up dissidents. People that were contrary to the actions of the government. And our names were listed with the FBI.
Sure.
You know, we understood that if they start rounding up dissidents, they're going to hit Zap Comics.
Right.
You know.
Sure.
So, fortunately, the country got liberal there all of a sudden about the Vietnam War, and we just come out of this thing smelling like a rose. But on the other hand, all over the United States, about 400 news dealers did go to jail over selling Zap comics. So, we bear that burden and guilt and responsibility for these poor people that had to go to jail selling our comic books. You know, we don't just take that for granted. So, I was already seasoned to know the responsibilities and the discomforts and situations that these comics created. So when I got time to these guys use this painting on Guns N' Roses, I knew exactly what was going to happen.
Interesting.
The painting was never intended for general public. It was intended for a special audience, a small audience that had investigative skills that would enjoy something like that.
Well, it's interesting to me that even, after so many years, the fight, during Zap, where you guys knew you were provoking, and it was necessary at the time to define that territory, aesthetically, mentally, and culturally.
Well, we had an axe to grind. We had an old axe to grind, all of us, because when they outlawed the really good comic books in the early 50s, because it's the Dr. Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent book, that they got rid of all the real good comic books in a Senate hearing. You know, all of a sudden...
Purient interest? Was that the argument?
Well, I said it was causing juvenile delinquency. Mm-hmm. They said there was too much violence in the comics and sexual luridness, and this was causing a whole generation of young people.
And which comics were these, the EC or the Fred Gaines?
EC, it was primarily the EC comics. That just about killed them except for Mad. We had that that revenge to issue out to the American world. It's like, you think those comic books are bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. You ain't seen nothing.
And you continued that aesthetic.
Well, I'm a liberal person, a free thinker,
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily a leftist, but I am extremely liberal, enormously liberal.
And do you still get flack?
Nah, not anymore. No. We have changed the world. We were part and parcel responsible for changing the world. We changed movies, television. That Zap had an enormous effect on the world that people don't realize. They just don't understand.
Well, it sort of started that ball rolling. I mean, yeah. I was thinking about coming over there today when I did a little reading about some of your history, and I was like, well, look at this now. It's almost like, you know, it was a completely, we live in a completely pornified
that's right.
state.
That's right. And yeah. we're surviving.
Yeah.
And it's good mental health. You know?
If you don't
it's
get too deep. Health. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you limit your masturbation to to a reasonable amount of time per week.
No, no.
Do you think there is any repercussions? Any negative downside to it?
There's certainly a small percentage, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, there's some people that are just hostile anyway.
Right, right. Do you feel vindicated?
Yeah. When I was doing the punk rock art, I got a big following with tattoo artists, say, skateboard artists, surf artists, surf world. So I was getting a lot of write-ups in rock and roll magazines and stuff, getting an enormous amount of press, you know, and the stuff you'd never get in the art world. The art world's a very limited world,
yeah.
a boring universe. So I was talking to this gal at one of these tattoo magazines, and I says, you know, we ought to do a whole magazine of just this kind of art, you know. So she called, you know. What I explained to her was that there were some magazines out in France in the 20s and 30s for the surrealists that were really interesting, you know. Yeah. And maybe it's time to do something like that now. Not like the boring art magazines that are on the stands now, you know, but some really interesting stuff like there used to be a magazine called Minotaur and the Surrealist Revolution and stuff back in the 20s and 30s. And I told her about that, and she called me back 2 weeks later and says, well, I've got that magazine. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, I talked to my publisher, and we do that magazine. So they did it, and I was the conduit that fed in the artists for the magazine because I knew all underground artists. Name of the magazine was Art Alternatives, and it did really, really well.
I bought that magazine. I think I had the first one.
Did really, really well.
Yeah.
And then they fired the girl. So I guess the publisher was under the impression that, well, we can just get any crazy shit in here and it'll sell, you know. So anyway, it didn't do well at all after that. And so I was talking to Greg Escalante and my wife, Susanna, whatnot, about, well, maybe we should find an underwriter and buy that title, put it back on the stands.
Yeah.
So I tried to, I went to Timothy Leary to see if he could get me an audience with Larry Flint, and that didn't work out. And I tried a couple other connections. I couldn't do any good. Then Greg Escalante reminded me that I'd done two covers for Thrasher, and maybe I ought to try to get a hold of Fausto Attila up in San Francisco. And so called him and told him we would like to start a magazine, and we want to buy this title, Art Alternatives, that went down the drain. And so we tried to buy that title, and they would not sell it. So I said, well, I'll come up with a title. And I wrote a list of 120 titles. So they took about 10 of those titles and took them to a lawyer to have them see if they were clean, and they picked Juxtapose. So Juxtapose came out in the winter of 1994 with 23,000 issues, and it did remarkably well. It was in the black immediately. It just did great. And I was feeding the artist in there and, you know, supplying them artists and whatnot. So then it was quarterly. So then the next issue came out, and it was great. It sold. This thing was just selling like crazy. And not only was it selling really good, but it had one of the largest sell-throughs of a magazine. Now, a sell-through is if you print 100 magazines, 35 of them will end up in the hands of people, and 65 will go in the recyclables. That's the way magazines are. Well, on Juxtapose, the distributors immediately realized this thing had like 65, 70% of sell-through. It's just unheard of.
Yeah.
So then the print runs went way up, and after a couple of years, it went from quarterly to bi-monthly, and then later monthly. And this first thing we noticed, well, the thing outsold Art Forum.
Sweet.
And then a little while goes by, a year or two goes by, and it outsells Art in America. Right? Time goes by, and it outsells Art News. And we discover, well, this is the top-selling art magazine in the world we've got here, you know. And so originally, no art school would allow it in the class. You know, now it's in every art school. So if I have a legacy, maybe that's it. Now, that isn't, you know, that helped a lot of artists. And there's a handful of artists that came out of Juxtapose that are now millionaires. See? Now, I guess I would take that as a legacy. But I think my legacy that I would want was what I do in paintings. You know, mm-hmm. it's the fact that... they said in the 80s that painting was dead. Well, painting hadn't even started. Painting hadn't even started because it's such a narrow-minded period of time. The conceptualists just really tried to get rid of painting completely. And so the area of imagination, the playing field for art, is so gigantic that no one's really... really explored it, you know, and that would be the legacy I'd want to leave, is the exploration of what imagination can lead to and how it would compound itself and become exponential. Mm-hmm. In other words, what my generation does, I'd like to see another younger generation come and step on that and make that go one step further into wild abstraction, you know, into the just compound the poetry, mm-hmm. make it lyrically remarkable.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, you can stand in front of almost any one of your canvases for at least, you can really spend at least 2 hours trying to work that shit out, trying to make it, it's not about making sense, but it's about taking a journey, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's hard for me to keep a straight face with such a wonderful remark. But now I'm right here, I'm showing it. Barnsdale Park at the Los Angeles Municipal Museum. And I came here originally in 1964 to see a Salvador Dali show. And I told all my contemporaries, my fellow students, fellow artists, well, there's a Dali show up there at Barnsdale Park, and none of them would go. They were not interested. It had nothing to do with abstract expressionism. It was just that old phony realism, you know. So of all the places I've shown, to come back here and have an art show here, you know, it's just, it's such an honor and such a fulfillment, you know.
Yeah.
So if I fall over dead tomorrow, I'll be looking good. You know?
Thank you, Robert Williams. That's a beautiful way to end. So that's it. That's the show. I hope you enjoyed that. I did the best I could. I think we got comfortable. I think things started to get comfortable with me and Robert eventually there. And I'm just fascinated with his work. Go check out his work by all means. Respect. So what else? Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. The new tour dates will be up there. There's some pre-sales I told you about earlier. You should be able to get in on that. Boomer lives!